From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and world leaders are in New York today for the meeting of the UN General Assembly. Security is heavy. The UN is less than 2 miles from the site of that bombing over the weekend that has been called an act of terror. Inside the UN, Syria's civil war is on the agenda today. The UN says it has suspended all convoys into Syria after an airstrike hit a convoy headed for the besieged city of Aleppo yesterday, and at least 20 civilians were killed. The strike came just hours after Syria's military declared an end to a week-long ceasefire negotiated by the U.S. and Russia, although Secretary of State John Kerry says the ceasefire is not over. At the U.N. today, President Obama said the international community must continue to work with those who seek to build rather than destroy.
A place like Syria, where there is no ultimate military victory to be won, we're going to have to pursue the hard work of diplomacy that aims to stop the violence and deliver aid to those in need and support those who pursue a political settlement and can see those who are not like themselves as worthy of dignity and respect.
Well, just as the news was breaking about the aid convoy bombing yesterday, I spoke with Dominic Graham, Syria response director from the global humanitarian organization Mercy Corps. He joined us on Skype from Amman, Jordan, and I asked him how successful his group has been in delivering aid to Syria over the past week.
On one level, we have been fairly successful. We've been able to continue with our humanitarian operations across much of Syria. We work in some of the most difficult areas to reach within the country, help on average 600 to 650,000 vulnerable civilians every month. So it's quite a large number of people. And for many, we're the only source of food for those families. We've been able to maintain that through the ceasefire. What's been more frustrating for us, of course, is that we were hoping that with the peace that the ceasefire brought with it, we would be able to reach besieged areas such as Aleppo that we haven't been able to get to for several months now. We were unsuccessful in that so far, and we found that deeply frustrating because the people in those besieged areas are really the most vulnerable in the country.
Well, how are they getting food if you're not able to get it to them?
Well, for some period of time, people were living off stocks. People were always expecting that things might turn for the worst. So households had shelves of cans and other non-perishable items. Wholesalers and stores kept stocks. And so for some period of time, they were able to just string out those stocks. But then as time went by and they worked down those stocks, prices start to increase to a point that most people couldn't afford even basics anymore. Markets closed, bakeries closed. Fresh food became completely unavailable. Many people no longer have access even to clean drinking water, and hygiene essentials like soap and diapers have gone off the shelves as well. And so there's been a squeeze on living standards, you might say, on just everyday life within besieged areas of Aleppo that makes things intolerable for them. It's been a struggle for people. They've survived to this point. But without humanitarian assistance getting into those areas, the future looks very tough indeed.
And you said that you were unable to get aid to people in Aleppo. Are you going to continue to try to do that, or is it just too unsafe right now?
We'll absolutely keep trying. What we were looking for was a 24-hour window within which it was feasible for us to make a safe passage from Turkey, which is where our stocks are held, into Aleppo. We weren't able to do that. The United Nations had a 20-truck convoy, which was to be the first convoy into Aleppo. It sat just across the border inside Syria, but in no man's land, effectively, ever since the beginning of this week. And I think until we see that convoy make a safe passage into Aleppo, we'll be waiting. That said, when the time comes, we're ready to go. We have stocks prepared, boxed, and ready to move. So should the situation transform into something that we can work with, then we would be able to move very quickly.
And beyond food and drinking water, what other things do people need?
The highest priority is medical supplies. As you can imagine, medical supplies run down and some are easier to store than others. So that's very high on the list. Second on the list outside of food is fuel. Hospitals, again, need fuel to power the generators. Families need fuel in order to cook. And if we get into the winter months, I hope We don't find ourselves in the winter months in this same situation. But if we do, families will start needing fuel for heating as well. And of course, just movement around the town requires fuel as well. So fuel always comes up as a high priority. Food is big, but also flour within that. There's a strong tradition of bakery, of breads and so forth. And so flour as a standalone item comes up very high. And as I mentioned before, hygiene items such as soaps and diapers and so forth are also in short supply right now.
Does this ceasefire feel like an opportunity right now to you, or does it feel like eventually we'll just revert back to what has been going on in Syria over the past many years?
Well, people inside Syria were more skeptical. They've seen the ebb and flow of the war in a very personal way for a number of years now, and there's a lot more skepticism coming from people there. From our side, I think we felt a cautious optimism. As I said before, it was great that those actors with political leverage within Syria, including the US, including Russia and others, have been able to show some reward for their political effort this past week. And that gave me hope that perhaps we were on a optimistic track now. Of course, the ceasefire is not perfect. Of course, it on its own doesn't get us to a conclusion. But it did feel like a step forward, and I hope we can maintain that progress.
That's Dominic Graham, who is the Syria Response Director for Mercy Corps. Dominic, thank you.
No trouble. Good talking with you.
One photographer, one neighborhood in Brooklyn, 10 years' worth of images. When the new National Museum of African American History and Culture opens this weekend, one of the exhibits will be a collection of photographs from the late 1930s to the 1940s taken by a young African American woman. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, she chose to show images of life at its best.
Laura Fitzpatrick took portraits, hundreds of them. At the time, Americans were still pulling themselves out of the Depression. Then World War II raged. Discrimination against African Americans was a brutal fact of life. Yet there is barely a hint of these struggles in Fitzpatrick's images. A young couple sunbathing on Coney Island. A group of friends sitting on big rocks in the park. A mother and her children after church.
We were really amazed by the fact that it was a single photographer, and it documented the way in which a community was shaped, the way it was formed, and how people lived.
Rhea Combs is a photography and film curator with the African American Museum. She says the collection was donated by Laura Fitzpatrick's children. Fitzpatrick was born in Mount Meigs, Alabama in 1927. Her son, Daniel Evans, says it was her mother who gave her the camera when she was 10 years old.
While my grandmother was working hard, she also wanted my mother to have something to do during the day. And she took to it.
It was one of those accordion folding cameras, and Evan says Fitzpatrick took it everywhere. Her subjects were friends and neighbors in the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn. Many of them had also migrated north from southern states like Alabama and Mississippi. In one photo, three sharply dressed young women stand side by side on a city sidewalk. Rhea Combs reads the caption Laura Fitzpatrick wrote.
This is junior high school style.
Junior high school style has changed a lot. And they're wearing suits and skirts
that go beneath their knees with bobby socks and, you know, saddle shoes.
Everybody said, wow, look how dressed up they are. And it's like, yeah, and their parents were domestic workers, janitors. There really wasn't money around, but that never stopped them from holding their heads up high and looking forward to the future.
Laura Fitzpatrick didn't have any formal training in photography, and yet she took great care to stage her portraits. She took lots of pictures on the rooftop of the public housing she and her mother lived in. Another favorite spot was in front of the Star Employment Agency. Posing in front of the Brooklyn storefront in 1944, a young man wears a buttoned-up suit and tie. A young woman is wearing a long, stylish wool coat with a fur collar.
That was everyone's goal, to be able to finish high school and go into the Star Employment Agency and let them know, hey, I'm ready to work.
Whatever struggles there must have been, Laura Fitzpatrick captured a sense of joy in the people she photographed, whether it was a family portrait or a group of friends in the park. And for curator Rhea Combs, that's the point.
This provides this kind of counter-narrative in a way that allows us to sort of see African Americans thriving, enjoying life, that it wasn't always this kind of, sort of depressed existence by any stretch of the imagination. And so you see the resilience and the fortitude and just the beauty of everyday existence.
But after high school, Laura Fitzpatrick didn't have as much time for photography.
If she had a druthers, she would have become a professional photographer. But for African-American women with a high school education in 1945, she decided to become a nurse.
Laura Fitzpatrick enrolled in the YWCA School of Nursing. She got married and raised four children. She was a nurse at Brooklyn's Brookdale Hospital for 33 years. She died in 1987. Daniel Evans believes his mother knew her photographs would have cultural and historic relevance someday. She was, he says, the only person in the neighborhood with a camera. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
All this week, we're talking about climate change, and with less than 2 months until Election Day, we want to talk about the politics of climate change today. For that, we're joined by Evan Lehman, Deputy Editor of Environment and Energy Publishing's Climate Wire. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And let's start with the current candidates for president. In a recent questionnaire by Scientific American, Hillary Clinton called climate change an urgent threat and a defining challenge of our time, while Donald Trump famously tweeted in 2012, the concept of global warming was created by and for the Chinese in order to make U.S. manufacturing non-competitive. Now, Trump has since said that statement was a joke, but he still doesn't think climate change is much of a problem. Here he is in an August interview with the Miami Herald.
Well, I'm not a big believer in man-made climate change. There could be some impact, but I don't believe it's a devastating impact.
And here's Hillary Clinton at a rally in Tampa earlier this month after Hurricane Hermine made landfall in Florida.
When it comes to protecting our country against natural disasters and the threat of climate change, once again, Donald Trump is totally unfit and unqualified to be our president.
So, Evan, we hear a lot there about what they're saying. Is there more to it than that? Or tell us more about what we should know about each candidate and climate change.
Well, it's a really good question. There's a lot of friction between the two candidates' views on climate change in this presidential election. In 2012, Obama and Mitt Romney hardly talked about the issue. In 2008, Obama and John McCain agreed on it and wanted to pass cap and trade. And here you've got Donald Trump calling it a hoax, and you've got Hillary Clinton, saying that she'll pursue ambitious regulatory efforts to diminish it.
Well, you mentioned cap and trade. That was passed by the House in 2009. It never got a vote in the Senate. Tell us about cap and trade and what it is, how it works, because if somebody gets into office and decides they want to do something, that may well be one of the things that they decide they want to do.
Yeah. So cap and trade, was the preferred policy option in climate change in 2009 and 2010. And it would limit emissions in virtually every sector of the American economy, from utilities to transportation to manufacturing. It's seen as a pretty good way by economists to reduce emissions while allowing those industries to sort of choose how they do that.
Well, why didn't it work back then? Why didn't it pass?
Because a handful of Democrats in states like Montana, North Dakota, Arkansas, Pennsylvania couldn't get on board because they were concerned that it would raise electricity prices and energy prices in their state and hurt manufacturing in their state. And Republicans were unified against it.
And do you think that if Hillary Clinton is the next president, that there's a chance the cap and trade debate could come back?
I doubt it. Her campaign has not explicitly opposed a carbon tax, although she hasn't endorsed it either. A carbon tax is seen as a little bit more in vogue these days because it might be put into a larger tax reform package that might cut corporate tax rates, for example, which is something that Republicans really want. But the Clinton campaign is not talking about a carbon tax.
I want to talk about climate skepticism because we talked about it with Donald Trump, but this is one of the reasons why these things can't get passed. And let's listen here to just last year, Senator James Inhofe, Republican, tossing a snowball on the Senate floor to mock the idea of global warming.
We keep hearing that 2014 has been the warmest year on record. I asked the chair, you know what this is? It's a snowball. And that's just from outside here. So it's very, very cold out, very unseasonal. So here, Mr. President, catch this.
Now, we know that climate scientists would say these two things can go together. There can be global warming and that can lead to much bigger winter storms, for example. But how much is this skepticism or climate denial a political factor in the U.S. today beyond Donald Trump?
I think it's a very big factor. Many in the Republican Party won't, talk about climate change at all. It's sort of become this partisan ideological position where Republicans just refuse to sort of acknowledge it because it could entice a primary opponent in their districts, for example. But we are beginning to see a slight thawing in the Republican Party. 13 House Republicans last year offered a resolution that says climate change is human-made and is real. And we've also seen a change among the American population as well. 64% of Americans now say they're worried a great deal or a fair amount about it. That's up 9 points over a year and marks the highest rate in 8 years.
Well, and in fact, there's a new AP poll out that finds 71% of the American public want the federal government to do something about global warming, including 6% who think the government should act even though they're not sure that climate change is happening.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? People tend to want to reduce greenhouse gases if you ask them. And they tend to say that they would be willing to pay a little bit to do that too, polls show.
That's Evan Lehman, who is deputy editor of Environment and Energy Publishing's Climate Wire. Evan, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, in Miami Beach, politicians are not waiting for a consensus in Washington to act on climate change. They can't afford to. The city is just a few feet above sea level, and high tides can flood it. That's something that's happening more often. Back in March, I met up with Susie Torriente, the assistant city manager and the chief resiliency officer in Miami Beach at a waterfront park there, to hear what the city is doing to deal with climate change.
The neighborhood that we're standing in right now is one of the first ones where the roads are being elevated and storm pumps are actually pumping the water out into the bay. We're essentially replacing the old gravity system that's, close to 100 years old, and replacing it with these pumps to quickly move the water off the roads.
And tell us how much of that is happening at this point. We hear stories about major flooding in Miami Beach, but what's it like?
It's called sunny day flooding. It's during the king tides that we get in the fall or in the spring. And the streets that where we have made the investments and we've put in the pumps and elevated the roads, you won't see those pictures of Miami Beach flooding anymore.
But in the places where it does flood, how bad is it?
It comes in with the tides and it could, reach probably up to your knee. And then it just flows back out with the tides.
And is that something that didn't used to happen?
If you speak to people who've been here, a long time, they'll remember it. But what's happening, it's happening more often with what's happening with climate change and sea level rise.
If you didn't do anything to raise the roads and other efforts, what would happen with these floods?
Well, we have projections from the region that say that we could have 1 to 2 feet of sea level rise, within the next, 50 years or so. But we are investing. We are putting in, whether it's backflow preventers into our existing gravity pipes, or we put in the pumps to push the water out. Those investments are actually helping to reduce our risk.
How expensive is that?
It's expensive. Yeah.
What are we talking about?
It's about a $400 million program over, let's say, 3 to 5 years. And it's paid by the stormwater fees that our residents pay.
It's all paid through local fees?
All local.
That's a lot of money for a city to pay.
Look around. It's beautiful Miami Beach, and people want to live here, and our residents and our city commission have made that commitment to invest.
How much support do you have from each party in doing stuff like this, making these investments? Because it's not always a popular thing to make investments to deal with climate change in this country.
Well, in South Florida, climate change is not a partisan issue. It's not a Republican issue. It's not a Democrat issue. Both the R's and the D's, they know that they have to invest. Local government is really at the front lines of dealing with climate change.
What about the governor, though? Because he's gotten in trouble for people ask him about climate change and he says, well, I'm not a scientist.
What about the governor? The governor is not part of these programs.
So it's not a problem that the governor is not on board with you?
It would be great if the state and the federal government would, you know, be part of the solution and with policies and with dollars coming in, but they're not. So the local governments are really fronting the whole issue.
You know, this is a place that more than almost any other I've seen in the United States is just booming with development, huge buildings going up all over the place. And as I look at them and I know about the problems with the sea level rise here, I think, well, I hope anybody that's buying in that building is buying up above the second floor. But it doesn't seem to be stopping people from moving here.
No, people still want to be in South Florida. It's a great place to visit, to live, to work, to play. Development is still going on. I think that it's important to note what the development is going along in accordance with the Florida Building Code, with the FEMA flood maps, and we're looking at elevation, and we're looking at elevation for seawalls, looking at, you know, again, maybe first floors that are not places that are inhabitable in the future. So again, those are all things that are part of the textbook that we're writing on sea level rise.
But there are actually places where the first floors will not be inhabitable in the future.
I don't have the crystal ball, and I don't know what it's going to look like. But I do think that in the future, the urban fabric and the urban design will be different. And we'll start to incorporate water and live with water a little more than we have been.
Our conversation in Miami Beach with Susie Torriente, the assistant city manager and chief resiliency officer there. And tomorrow, as we continue our series on climate change, we're going to hear from three other cities in this country that are trying to deal with the effects: New Orleans, Los Angeles, and Boulder, Colorado.
The Centers for Disease Control says obesity is a common, costly, and serious problem. One in three American adults is considered obese, and Texas has one of the country's highest obesity rates. So researchers in San Antonio are using volunteers to help build an obesity genome registry. They hope the data bank will someday provide clues on how to tailor weight loss strategies. Wendy Rigby from Texas Public Radio reports.
Stepping on the scale can be a frustrating routine for millions of people carrying around extra pounds. People like Judy Winkler of Hondo, Texas. At 5'2", she weighed 185 at her heaviest.
I never remember a time that I wasn't a little chubby girl. Always got picked last and everything because I couldn't run very fast.
Winkler is a volunteer in a new obesity research program called the TOPS Genome Registry. San Antonio's Texas Biomedical Research Institute is teaming up with the group TOPS, or Take Off Pounds Sensibly. The idea is to get family histories and DNA samples from thousands of people across North America. That data will live in San Antonio. Scientists will use the information to pinpoint genetic factors that weave into diet and exercise and impact obesity.
I think this will be an invaluable resource. This is the kind of effort that has potentially very long-term payoffs.
That's Dr. Tony Camuzzi. He works in genetics at Texas Biomed, and he says extra body fat produces a sort of chronic inflammatory condition that contributes to serious health problems, vascular disease, diabetes, liver problems. While similar genetic databanks give single-moment snapshots of a population, Texas Biomed plans to follow these volunteers for years and years.
And what this potentially allows us the opportunity to do is to follow individuals across the life course.
Elizabeth Brandt is filling out the questionnaire online. She never struggled with weight before she started having children. And while her parents were thin, all of her siblings are overweight.
I thought it would be good research to look at people both who had this in their history and those who hadn't, and see if there was any kind of a comparison.
Brandt opens a kit with a vial and spits into it. Her saliva will provide the crucial DNA sample. A robot in the genetics lab processes the samples collected since the program started 2 months ago. Texas Biomed has 10,000 DNA kits to start with, but they hope to convince hundreds of thousands of people to agree to help. Texas Biomed genetics chair Dr. Michael Olivier says there won't be any one gene to pinpoint, but eventually, he believes physicians will be able to tailor their weight loss advice to patients based on that person's individual history and genetics.
Bringing in this additional genetic information and studying this aspect will help physicians to use that information more effectively to advise patients in the future.
So there's never going to be the magic pill?
No, I do not believe so. I'm sorry for bursting that bubble. But I think what there will be is genetic information that can help choose what may work better for you.
Anyone can volunteer for the study by filling out a questionnaire online and agreeing to a DNA sample. The participants may not know any more about their genetic makeup, but they'll know they are contributing to research that could help future generations win the Battle of the Bulge. For Here and Now, I'm Wendy Rigby in San Antonio.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tracy Kidder is out with a new book today, and he's back in the world of engineers, looking at one in particular. The book is called A Truck Full of Money, and it chronicles the life of Paul English, the energetic techie who co-founded the travel website Kayak. Kidder's profile of English echoes the well-known book he published back in 1981 called The Soul of a New Machine. That one was about a team of engineers in a race to build a new computer's hardware. But this latest story is also personal. Paul English forged his career in technology despite a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Tracy Kidder and Paul English join me now. And Tracy, you've written several award-winning biographies and you had the whole world to choose from. So what was it about Paul English that drew you to him?
Well, first, I had written this book, The Soul of a New Machine, years and 30-some years before, and I...
1981, right?
Yeah, and I fled from that subject. And then, I guess, you know, I'd been casting about to try to figure out what to do next, and I knew Paul from Partners in Health. He was an important donor and member of the board there. We just talked, and he was going to be my guide, show me around this brave new world. I was just curious, I thought. And after a while, I decided that... my guide should become my subject. And I said to him, why don't I write about you? And it took him a few months at least to say, all right.
Why did it take you so long?
The provision was very interesting,
yeah.
If I might say.
Yeah, please
said,
do.
You'd have to promise not to make me look better than I am.
It's funny. You know, my day job, I sometimes am in the spotlight relating to my companies. I'm actually shy. I would say I'm an introvert who's learned how to be an extrovert a little bit. I think the thing about don't make me better than I am was just me being nervous about, I mean, being a subject of Tracy Kidder's book is quite a thing, quite an honor. And I was afraid of being on a pedestal, and I just let people down for the rest of my life.
Well, so Tracy, let me ask you about that, because I was looking at a review of the book. It was very well reviewed in the New York Times, but there's a particular phrase that the Times reviewer used, which I wanted to get your reaction to, because the Times reviewer said, you know, these days it's not that uncommon for us to see biographies that celebrate the barons of the new economy, right? And so the idea that there are a lot of books out there about very successful, you know, tech entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. and, you know, what really distinguishes Paul's story from
theirs?
I'll
tell you, a bunch of things. You know, we're all born with something to struggle against, and Paul was born with something bigger to struggle against than most people, it seems to me. Bipolar disorder, I hope that's okay to say. And on top of that, Paul is generous. Now, and Paul's a philanthropist. I don't think there are too many of these barons who would say something like Paul said to me, sitting on a park bench with a homeless guy, remembering that friends of his had said to him, after Kayak was sold for about $2 billion, you know, that he felt uncomfortable about the money he'd gotten from Kayak. And they said, oh, you shouldn't feel that way. You worked hard for your money. And Paul's response to that is they're kind of saying that you're only poor because you're lazy. And the second thing he said was, the truth is, I didn't work that hard. I'm just good at something that makes a lot of money. And I, you know, I went out looking for a window on this world, this crazy world of high-tech entrepreneurship of, you know, internet commerce and so on. And what I found was, as I often have, is that the window was more interesting than the view.
Well, Paul, I mean, if you don't mind, could we talk a little bit about your bipolar disorder?
Sure, yeah.
I mean, because I think it might surprise a lot of people to hear that the founder of this very successful company, Kayak, is and was struggling with a mental illness of that kind during all that time. I mean, did it help you? Did it harm you? I mean, how did you manage it?
It probably did a bit of both. I think it helped more than harmed. The worst part of being bipolar, at least in my personal experience of the downs, I suffered mostly with depression in my 20s and maybe early 30s. Luckily, there's a med that I've been taking now for about 10 years that's really helped protect me on the lows. But I still struggle is not exactly the right word, but I still struggle with the hypomania. Mm. I would say in general, being in the creative industry, the hypomania is an asset because you're filled with enormous energy and grandiosity and just attracted to shiny new objects and thinking that this new idea, whether it's my idea or an idea for one of my colleagues, when I latch onto something, I just push it really, really hard. I end up not sleeping for, you know, many, many long periods of time, or asleep just 2 or 3 hours a night. The energy burst then I think is very helpful to the creativity, but there's a downside to the hypomania as well, and that's something I've had to manage over the years.
Well, were you in a hypomanic phase when you had, or I don't know if there was one aha moment for the creation of Kayak?
Yeah, definitely. Especially in the early years, I became obsessed with two things, maybe actually three things. One was just trying to build this incredible team. And I think being manic or hypomanic, it was actually really useful to me as a recruiter, because when I met people, again, I have sort of the shiny new object syndrome, where when I meet something new, either a new idea or a new person, I become kind of obsessed with collecting that idea, or in some cases that person. And I think that energy really helped me recruit quite an exceptional team. The second thing was the product itself. Back in 2004, when we started Kayak and I looked at Expedia and some of the other top travel sites, I just saw there was an enormous opportunity to create something simpler. And I think the energy bursts help with a lot of the creativity around that. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing is my obsession with customer support. And I love talking to customers.
Well, I mean, Tracy, you kind of approached this question head on in the book about whether or not Paul's bipolar disorder helped him or hindered him. I mean, we've got an answer from Paul, but I'm wondering how...
That would be the definitive one, probably, but I think I left it ambiguous. I mean, I don't like the romantic notion that somehow mental illness is necessary to the creation of art and other things. But I do know also that Paul himself felt, you know, at times that there was a big downside. You know, grandiosity cuts both ways, right?
But of course, I mean, it is bipolar disorder,
yes,
right? And so there's the depressive phases,
right,
as well.
Right, there's both sides of it.
But that you really had conquered.
I would say on the depressive periods, they would last weeks or sometimes months at a time. And it was quite crippling for me. I remember spending many, many days and weekends on the floor of my bedroom. I couldn't even get up on the bed. I don't know how to explain that. I remember always in the middle of the night, sometimes having panic attacks and looking at the windowsill, hoping for light.
I mean, I want to reiterate, we don't want to sound as if we're romanticizing bipolar disorder or mental illness of any kind. And I also don't want to seem as if we're projecting that that tech entrepreneurs, you know, may exhibit these qualities any more than any other group of people. But nevertheless, I mean, Tracy, you've written about the fact that there's something about the tech and computer age that seems to have unlocked or allowed a certain type of mind to really flower.
That's not my idea. It comes largely from this man, Donald Knuth, who is probably the greatest living computer scientist. And he's a fascinating man, and he has this notion that about 2% of humanity is perfectly suited to programming computers. He thinks that probably the people who created the pyramids probably would have been great computer programmers if there had been computers back then. So it was a human ability at waiting its moment, at waiting its instrument.
It's all on a spectrum as well. And even within the software industry, which is where I work most, you know, where I spend my career, I think there are a lot of people who exhibit a lot of traits of bipolar illness, particularly on the manic side. It does make it interesting with people who are touched with different mental conditions and abilities. I often say that many of the best engineers fit sort of somewhere on the spectrum towards Asperger's, for example. And I think some of the best engineers I've ever worked with, I would say, are on the spectrum. So I think bringing different types of minds into a creative pursuit, I think, creates great products.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, speaking of great products, so as you mentioned before, you and your co-founder sold Kayak to Priceline, right?
That's right.
$2 billion.
That's right.
You did quite well. But you didn't come, I mean, you, growing up, you didn't come from money. And so I'm just wondering what made you then decide that with this new wealth, extreme wealth that you had, that you were going to go down the path of philanthropy? Because you mentioned Paul Farmer's group, Partners in Health, at the beginning of our conversation. I think people would be completely understanding if you decided you were going to keep a lot of it.
So I grew up in a what I would say is a working class family in West Roxbury. My father worked for Boston Gas Company for 49 years. He was a pipe fitter by trade. And so we didn't have a lot of extra money. Sometimes I don't recognize that I'm quote unquote rich myself. I look at people with wealth and I just think they're a very different animal than I am. I think it's a disaster to hoard money. I don't think it makes sense to have a big bank account because money in a bank account isn't doing anything for you. I live in a nice home. I have a few nice cars. I'm not sure what else I need. So I think my money is most efficient if I actually give it away and find people who need it more than I need it.
Well, Tracy Kidder's new book is A Truck Full of Money, One Man's Quest to Recover from Great Success. It's about Paul English, the co-founder of the travel website Kayak. Tracy Kidder and Paul English, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And remember that catchphrase, there's an app for that? Well, today you might revise it to say there are too many apps for that and people have reached their limit. New data from the analytics company Comscore says about half of American smartphone users are downloading zero apps per month. Not great news for Apple's App Store or Google Play, and it's worse news for app makers. For more, let's check in with our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Dan Frommer is editor-in-chief at Recode. He joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Dan.
Hey, good morning.
So what is going on here? Why are people downloading so many fewer apps than they used to?
I think the biggest thing is that the app market has matured. The App Store launched more than 8 years ago. And, you know, if you look at the list of the top apps, a lot of them have been around for a long time. Things like Facebook, Google Maps. And many of them are owned by two big companies, Facebook and Google, the ones I just said.
So there's no need to download new apps at that point? I mean, I'm thinking about Uber. Probably a lot of people have downloaded Uber in the last year or Lyft or some of the new companies that we put on our phones because we need them.
Yeah, I mean, let's be real. People are still using apps a lot. App time is about 3/4 of all time on mobile. So there's a lot of usage going on, and there are still individual success stories that happen all the time. Pokemon Go,
right.
probably the most incredible app launch of all time, and it happened just this summer. So it's totally possible for a new app to take off, but it's not like the early days of the App Store where people were discovering all these new things they could do with their phones and downloading a bunch of new apps every month.
And does it indicate to you that we are leading in a direction that apps will be no more at a certain point, that we just won't download them anymore?
No, not at all. I mean, we'll probably download fewer of them over time unless, you know, something crazy happens that we can't predict and then, you know, none of this matters. But we'll still continue to use apps a lot. It's just a matter of, you know, adding new functions. There was a period of really huge growth, and now it's kind of tapered off.
So who does that affect in your world? Because there has been an entire industry built on creating apps for things, and companies all have to have their own apps.
Probably scrappy startups and indie app makers, because it's very easy to get a lot of attention for a new app if you're a big company or if you have a big brand attached to it, like Pokemon. It's much harder if you're independent or don't have as much money to invest in things like marketing. There's a market has taken off, mostly led by Facebook and Google, of paying to get people to download and install your app. That costs money, and if you don't have a lot of money, it's going to be harder for you.
And instead, what, you invest in mobile websites or what?
That's certainly one approach to it. I think a category like news is a good example, where a lot of news companies thought that they needed to make big, expensive apps. And for the majority of them, it hasn't worked out. It's worked pretty well for the New York Times, I would say, and actually NPR. But a lot of news organizations spent money on apps and then realized, oh, we also have to keep updating them every year or many times a year. And I would say that investment does not look so great for a lot of news organizations. But other things that you really need an app for example, Uber is a good example we talked about earlier. It uses things like location and storing data offline that Well, actually, I don't know if Uber stores any data offline, so I'm not going to put that in their cap. But it certainly does things with your phone cameras, photography apps, for example. Anytime you want to use the camera, that's best done with an app as opposed to a website. So the web will be great for a lot of things, but so will apps.
You know, in addition to app developers who would be affected if people decide that they're not going to download near as many apps as they used to, there's also a whole advertising industry based on advertising within apps or advertising for you to download new apps.
Exactly. And so advertising new apps, you know, if it's harder to get apps, harder to get people to download apps, then those ads are lucrative if companies have the money to spend on them. And then, you know, advertising within apps, as long as the amount of time that's spent in apps continues to grow, and it has been, that's great for that ad market too. So advertising is actually looking like a decent business model for app companies.
And what does this mean for Apple and Google if people are downloading fewer apps? Is that a big part of their business?
For Apple, it's not. Apple's business, you know, pretty much almost the almost all of it, but really the vast majority of their revenue and profit especially is from selling hardware.
Right.
So as long as the iPhone is the best phone for using apps, which I think it is, then Apple's in great shape. There are, you know, at least in terms of that, there are other issues with the growth of Apple that, you know, that are unrelated to the app market. Google, a little different. Google doesn't make much money from their apps either, but they are the world's biggest online advertising company. So,
right.
You know, and the app install market is one that they play in. So not great, but not terrible for them.
Well, we'd love to hear from our listeners about what they're doing when it comes to apps. They can weigh in at hereandnow.org. Dan Frommer, editor-in-chief at Recode, thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.